Hello and welcome to the next in our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2024, all of which are themed around the topic of equine well-being. Today we're talking parasites, worming, and why having the right program in place can benefit not only your own horse's well-being but the wider equine population as well. To discuss this topic, I'm joined by two experts in the field. First of all, I'm joined by Claire Shand. She is the director at Westgate's lab, which specialises in parasite control for horses, and she was voted Equine SQP of the Year in 2023. She sits on the core steering group for Canter, which is a pan-industry group that's been formed to tackle the increasing threat of wormer resistance. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you so much for having me. What an introduction.
And I'm also joined by Nicolette Housby-Skeggs, and she is the veterinary director at the Horse Trust, providing both on-site veterinary provision and internal and external training. So let's get the ball started, guys. First of all, what are some of the common parasites that can affect the equine population in this country? Claire, I'm going to start with you.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I mean, we're quite lucky with horses in that there's just a fairly limited range of parasites that can impact horses. So there are probably four main ones, which are our large and small redworm, our tapeworm and ascarid, which are ones that we need to test for regularly and can really cause pathological disease in horses. And then the four subsidiary ones, which I would say are our pinworm, which make the horses itch. There is lungworm, commonly affects donkeys but also can impact horses, liver fluke, and then one that it really is a parasite of sheep and cattle, and if we cross grades we need to be aware of those. And then the other would be bots, which aren't a true worm but they are what the ones that impact and go through the intestinal tract, so they're the ones that we really need to be aware of.
And Nicola, what are some of the health implications then of a horse that maybe has a heavy parasite burden?
Yes, there's a massive range. So you will see, I mean, some horses have these constantly really high fecal egg counts, and they're seemingly completely healthy with them. Other horses we see, really suffer, and we do lose some horses due to heavy parasite burdens. I think the main things we tend to see with them are this sort of failure to thrive in young stock. So they just struggle to gain weight, they struggle to kind of grow normally, they just don't look healthy, they have a poor coat, and really just look quite unwell. We'll quite often see diarrhea. Weight loss is quite common, so either failure to gain weight or weight loss in these cases. I think when they've got a really heavy parasite burden, their gut almost starts to leak protein, so you get this kind of lethargy that comes with that. If they get any kind of blockage within the gut, then we see colics with them. As Claire mentioned, you've got the lungworm and the ascarids, and you can see sort of parasitic pneumonias with those as well, so you can see respiratory signs. And as I say, in the really severe cases, we do lose some of these horses and they end up dying or being euthanized.
And can there be sort of long-term effects? So, if the horse has had a parasite burden and you treat it and get rid of those parasites, can the effects of that be sort of extend past that treatment?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a particular case that springs to mind that we saw a couple of years ago. We had a group of rescue ponies that came to us with really heavy redworm burdens. And we treated them when they first arrived. And the following year, they actually did pretty well. And then the year after that, so kind of 2 years afterwards, there were five of them at that point, and they all got a little bit sick in the kind of spring when we got that emergence of encysted redworm. One of them who'd been doing really well for about 18 months, we actually lost him that spring. And there was, despite endless amounts of treatment, there was just nothing we could do for him in the end.
And probably what I should have asked as well earlier is how are these parasites getting into your horse's system? Claire, maybe you want to take this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really helps to get an idea of what we're dealing with here. So most of the adult worms will live in the actual gut of the horse. But if you're a worm, you are evolved to lay tens of thousands of eggs every day, and those are then shared out in the dung and onto the pasture. Because we've got to think about, in evolutionary terms, when horses grazed really large areas, then the incidence then of those eggs hatching, and if you're a little tiny worm, your goal in life is to get back inside of a horse and carry on your life cycle. And in order to A, have a horse to come along and munch that larvae on the grass, and B, for it to be a horse and not another animal, because most of our parasites are species specific, then they did evolve to kick out an awful lot of eggs, like every day. And then within a few days, those eggs are hatching on our pasture. The larvae are wriggling away as far as possible because horses don't like to graze near their dung. They're climbing up that blade of grass and they're just hanging out there and they're waiting for that horse to come along. And there's a really fantastic image of like lots of tiny larval worms hanging out in a dewdrop, which then, I mean, it blows my mind every time I see it. And then you just multiply that, you know, in your head by what's going out there on your pasture. And that's the infection risk that's there as our horses are grazing. And because now they don't graze large plains, they tend to be in smaller fields and grazing back over the same land, particularly if our grazing management isn't as good as it could be, just think of that reinfection potential that's out there, that's going on. It's mind-blowing, really.
Yeah, it's quite a scary thought. It's sort of this invisible threat, really, isn't it?
Absolutely nailed it. Yeah, that.
And that probably leads me quite nicely on to my next question. So what can increase a horse's susceptibility then of becoming infected by these parasites? I mean, you mentioned there about sort of grazing in smaller areas, but what are maybe some of the other factors?
Yeah, it's really broad range of factors that influence that. And Cantor has done some fantastic work on that. One of their first outputs has been this risk table that people can use to really assess, are there horses at risk of parasite infection and what does that look like? And so we can remember that using the CANTER acronym, which goes alongside clinical history for C. And that's looking at, has the horse got any underlying disease? So anything systemic is going to impact a horse's ability to withstand parasite infection as well. So anything such as PPID, EMS, those sorts of things, or other gut-related disease is going to put them at a higher risk of that. We can go to the A, so age profile. Like, we know that the young and the old, as in any animals and humans, particularly at risk. And youngsters, you know, their immune systems are just so underdeveloped for that. And one event rider that we work with, Sarah Bullimore, she said to us, you know, I never had worms until I had youngsters, which is about right. You know, they just are so susceptible to them. And Ascarids are a parasite typically associated with young horses. And as horses get into adulthood, they more or less gain a good natural immunity to them. So just something to be aware of, that the natural defences then are there and present in the horse, helping to protect it. We've got N for number of horses. So more horses kept together, the higher density of them, you know, as we just talked about with that output on the pasture, that also affects it. So we're talking about like more than 2 acres per horse being a low risk, less than 1 acre per horse, so much more tightly packed, becoming higher risk. We've touched on testing. So when we test horses, we know that we tend to find like 80% of the worms in 20% of those horses. And that's just because of a natural predisposition. Like, there's so many factors that influence that, but we can then know which of those horses are carrying the burdens and target them while leaving other horses, as Nicola said, who are happily carrying those lower burdens without problem and disease. They can then be untreated, and then we can help this resistance thing, which we're going to go on and talk about. We've got environment. So the way that we keep our horses, the paddock management has a really big influence. So things like poo picking, cross grazing with other animals, resting and rotating pasture all help to break that life cycle mechanically rather than us having to rely on the chemicals, the wormers. So that can be a really effective way of doing that. And also then thinking about parasites as like transmissible disease. So they can come in with new horses and spread to other horses there in the pasture that they're grazing with if they're not tested and treated, if they're carrying them. And then all of these things then add up to a risk profile. And is your horse low, medium, high? And then how do you deal with that in terms of with your prescriber, with looking at your strategy for how you deal with parasites for the year to protect the horses from disease? And a recent straw poll that we did with Canter found that more than 40% of British horses are medium high in that cohort. But actually knowing is really important. Like, there's no shame in it. It's just like, how do you protect your horse then from this risk, and what can you do about it? So that's a really good resource, and I'm sure you can link to that. It's on the Canter website, freely available to download. It's a really useful tool as like a starter to begin to think about all those factors and how your horse fits into that and what you can do about it.
And we'll say, that's a really useful resource then. We'll make sure that link is available to anyone who's listening who wants to check that out. Have you got anything to add on that topic, Nicola?
That was an incredibly comprehensive run through the kind of risk profile. I think it's you always want to think about the two things that kind of influence whether an animal gets clinical disease or not. You've got the host factors, which is the horse itself. So does it have any comorbidities, is it young, old? Those are all the sorts of things that impact the animal's susceptibility to becoming sick. And then you've got the parasite factors. So, how many parasites are getting into them? How virulent are those parasites? Do those parasites have resistance? And it's going to be the balance of how susceptible the host is and how kind of tough the parasite is the balance of that is going to be what decides whether that animal becomes sick from those parasites or not. And the Canter mnemonic and working through that really helps to assess that, how much risk are my horses at, and therefore we can look at how we approach the worming strategy for that particular group, because sadly there's no one size fits all, which would be really lovely and really helpful, but sadly the world is just a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. This whole topic, it's very bespoke to individual horses and their individual needs, which is why having that idea of your horse's risk profile is so important, because it means you can then work with that to tailor the right program to have in place, to suit your horse and the environment he's kept in, as you said, those parasites, how resistant they are, which I think leads us on quite nicely then to, to what should a sort of a targeted worming program look like then for a kind of standard case?
So I think what we all please chip in, Claire, at any point. So I think, as I say, what would be really nice is to have this kind of one size fits all, and you can just kind of say, this is what we're all going to do, and it's going to work for every yard and every horse, and it doesn't matter where I go, which horses I see, I'm going to do the same thing. Sadly, that's not quite going to work. So what we're really thinking about when we're talking about targeted worming control is, rather than, in spring and autumn, we're going to worm with this, and through the summer, we're going to worm with this, this, and this, and then that will have us covered. Sadly, we know that is working less and less. And we know that at some point in the not too distant future, that's not going to work at all if we don't change things. So when we're thinking about targeted worming control, a lot of it comes from all the things that Claire just discussed. So looking at that risk profile of the animals and the environment that we're in, and then using our different tests that are available for our different types of worms, and looking at what time of year those particular parasites are most prevalent, and then using our tests in a way that helps to, so we can, our risk assessment kind of tells us how likely is it that they're going to have these parasites, and then our testing on top of that kind of tells us what is our burden within that individual group. And as Claire says, we're going to have normally 20% of our horses are causing 80% of our problems. So what we're looking at doing is finding So we might know we've got a medium risk herd, but what we don't know is within that herd, which are our 20% that are producing our eggs onto the pasture and therefore contaminating them. So it's about working out which of those animals are likely to be having the biggest impact on our environment and on our group in general, and then selecting those particular animals for treatment.
And what then are some of those tests then that people can be carrying out?
Yeah, well, really, I would say that a worm egg count is the cornerstone of any targeted program. It's a really good, easy way that you can get an idea, like a snapshot of what's going on inside each of those horses. Where are the high egg shedders? And as Nicola says, then that you can deal with those appropriately. And doing one is great, but it's really a series across a season that's going to give you that best information. And to do that from the whole herd, because they're so individual, each horse, and it's has so many different factors that govern its resilience. So you want to be testing all the horses and doing it at regular intervals. And for a healthy adult, that looks at around 12 weeks. If you had higher risk or younger, you'd probably shorten the gap between that. But certainly that's, you know, through the grazing season, doing those regular worm egg counts to determine, and only stepping in with a chemical when the horse then is at medium high burden or worm eggs present in the dung, to be able to break that life cycle there and leaving the others untreated. The worm egg count really test predominantly for our red worm and our ascarid, and the small red worm, I mean, by any other parasite, you know, 95% of all horses' infections are going to be this parasite. It's much the most numerous, most dangerous. We've really got to keep on top of it, and especially because its life cycles are so fast. The reason that we have to test so regularly is because an infection of small redworm can so quickly get out of hand. So we know they can go from egg to adult in like 4 to 5 weeks is the life cycle period for that. So really, really quick. So as well as our worm egg counts, and we do see tapeworm eggs in worm egg counts, but it's not definitive because of the way that they're come out of the dung in packets. So if we're not seeing tapeworm, we can't definitively say there it isn't there. So instead, we'd recommend we do an ELISA for that, which is either a blood or saliva test that we can do. And because of the life cycle of that parasite, we can do that every 6 months to a year, depending on the risk profile of it. We add in then to a regular test-based program the potential for, well, looking at our encysted redworm possibility. So for a low-risk horse, that might look like an ELISA blood test for them in the late autumn winter, and for our medium higher risk horse as a proactive treatment with a suitable larvicidal wormer. So that then is kind of like our annual plan, and then we add into that if there are other things going on, like a horse itching, do we need to test for pinworm, do we need to look for the possibility of lungworm or liver fluke, and have we seen any bot eggs, and that kind of looks at our holistic plan for the year, because that's really what we want to be getting at, is rather than an ad hoc, oh, I haven't done anything like for this for a while, it's really, right, I've got this covered, and I know that by doing this, I'm looking after the health of my horse effectively and not leaving myself open. And the other thing that we're also guided to do is what we call reduction testing, because we've got this thing called resistance that's growing with our wormers, so just like antibiotics, and it means that our chemicals are much less effective. So where we are needing to treat, you can do a worm egg count 10 to 14 days later to assess, has that been effective? Or could there be a chemical resistance present? And the research is showing us that actually most equestrian properties are going to have some level of wormer resistance, just because of how often we've used these chemicals and for how long. I mean, we first got our wormers in the 1960s, and like it revolutionized horse health. It was brilliant, until we then realized that by using them so actively as we were, we actually got into this pickle where the worms were evolving and actually the chemicals were becoming less effective. And even our most recent chemicals are from the 1990s. And like, you know, I mean, it pains me to say it, but that's a long time ago now, you know. So we have to now look at a different way of managing our parasite burdens if we're going to be able to continue to keep horses like we do and on the pastures that we do, because otherwise we're going to get into untreatable burdens, which, you know, is a whole headache, you know, of worry in terms of the parasites and the impacts that Nicola talked about then really like lived large in terms of disease risk of our horses.
So one of the things I think you mentioned in there was about resistance. What actually is this? Can you explain to me in a bit more detail?
Okay, so when we think about evolution, we always think about selection pressures. So what you want to pass on to the next generation is going to benefit their survival. And then the next generation after that have got even more chance of surviving. So when you give a wormer, there will always be some worms that just by chance will have genetics that make them more resistant to that wormer, so less likely to die when they contact that wormer. So if you have 10 worms and two of them happen to have a gene that's going to increase their chance of surviving, the 8 worms that are susceptible will die and the 2 that had those genetics that protected them will survive. So those two resistant worms can then go off and they can breed more and they can pass on that resistant gene. And then the next sort of round of worms, you'll maybe have 6 out of the 10 will have that resistant gene and they'll survive that wormer and then they'll go on to reproduce and pass on those genetics. And the problem we've got is there's no selection pressure for non-resistance. So there's absolutely no benefit to a worm having susceptible genes. So the chances of that resistance ever reversing is really, really low because there's no pressure for it to go the other way. So what you end up with over time is this resistance gets passed on. Your genetic pool of resistance becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Does that answer the question? Have you got anything you can add in, Claire?
I know, I think you explained that brilliantly. Yeah, really great.
So what I'm sort of taking this is some of these drugs that we're using to them for wormers are becoming, I guess, then less effective. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so the more resistant genes we have out there, the more worms that are resistant, the less likely it is that that drug will kill that worm. Therefore, all we're really doing is flushing a wormer through a horse or sort of flushing our cash through a horse without it having any positive impact on that potential for clinical disease.
Yeah, and I think now we've only got 5 licensed chemicals. And the thing that I find most worrying is that there is now resistance to pretty much every single one being identified. So we've known for a long time that our older style chemicals like fenbendazole and pyrantel there's a lot of particularly small red worm resistance, those worms being the most common, some of our most dangerous. But now we've got our ivermectins and our moxidectins for the first time last March, we had the first resistance reported, like actual in a published study in this country in UK thoroughbred farms. So that is really, really worrying. You know, we've known anecdotally that becoming less effective, but actually we've got full blown resistance established to that. And we can add into that then another published paper from the autumn of 2023 from Martin Nielsen, which then has also started to raise concerns about our tapeworm treatments. So praziquantel and the double dose of pyrantel, that's both of those treatments, the only treatments we have for equine tapeworm, again, now being suspect as much less effective. So, and in every single parasite, we are now getting classes of this resistance emerging, which is really, really worrying.
Yes, it's sort of almost a ticking time bomb there that we've got to, as you say, we can't completely diffuse because this is the situation, but we have to then take these steps to minimise it and try and prolong the life of these drugs.
For sure.
Yes, it's one of those, again, we alluded to it at the start. And this is very important not only for your own horse, but it is that wider equine population, because if, you know, resistance is a really serious issue that affects the entire horse population, as you've alluded to there, Claire.
Oh, completely. I mean, like, it impacts business, our ability to keep horses into the future. I mean, this invisible problem is really now raising its head to cause disease, death in horses. It's not now the premise of like ignorance and neglect, it's actually that the chemicals aren't working. That, and Nicola, I'm sure you're seeing it more and more, disease and death caused by parasites. Frightening.
Yeah, and I think it's really heartbreaking actually when you do see these horses dying of parasite infections. And I think the thing that's always I find quite amazing is when you see, especially these younger ponies that come in with really high parasite burdens that you successfully treat, the difference those drugs can make when they're really needed is incredible. I mean, it's just transformational. And to think that we might lose those for those animals that benefit so much from them when they are needed, is quite heartbreaking to imagine a world where there isn't. And there are cases where now we can't treat them and we can't get them right, but there are also some cases where we really can. And so to protect those drugs for those animals that really need them is just so, so important.
And I suppose this is why it's so important to, when you're putting together this program, doing your testimonies, is to work with your vet, work with an SQP, someone who knows these drugs, knows what drugs go and treat which worms and which problems, and what, you know, that's why it's so important to work with these people who know this, so that you get it right, so that you have to do as little treatment as possible. And in the cases where you do, you treat with the correct drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing, actually, I was just going to say when Claire was talking through the testing, is making the most of the tests, because obviously, you know, none of us want to be spending any more money than we have to, right? So, you know, things like worm egg counts. I think, and Claire, please correct me if I'm wrong, I think Westgate have a really nice guide to getting a really good sample so that you've got the best chance of getting an accurate worm egg count. So, you know, the eggs aren't equally dispersed amongst the entire dung pile. So, you know, making sure you get a sample from kind of across that, and you're doing pooled samples. So, you know, you can do it over a couple of days to try and really increase your chance of that being an accurate sample. The saliva test, some people have a lot of success with. I think I'm really impatient, but so I always cheat and use the blood test. But you know, the blood tests are really good. They're at testing exposure, so just when you're thinking about reduction tests, the blood tests aren't useful for the reduction the same way the worm egg counts are. So just making sure that you're consulting you know, SQP, your vet, one of your veterinary nurses, just about which tests are most appropriate at which time, so that you're getting really good value for money when you are testing.
Yeah, because I say we're all looking to save pennies, because horses are very good at eating into your bank balance, so the more we can minimize that, the better here for all of us.
Absolutely.
And you know, once you've got this sort of this program in place, I guess, I mean, and again, Claire sort of mentioned it earlier with that risk profile, is there must be a management element to this as well to help reduce the parasite burden on your yard. What are some of the things then that people can be doing at their yards to make sure they're doing this properly?
Do you want to answer this one, Nicola, or do you want me to jump in on it?
I can start, and then feel free to jump in at any point. There's definitely an ideal world of what we'd all do, and then there's the reality. And so I think ideal world, which I think is fascinating. So it was shown that twice weekly poo picking is five times more effective than using ivermectin every week, every 8 weeks, which I just think is absolutely phenomenal.
Nicola.
It's just fantastic. And you know, it's free exercise, saves on a gym membership as well. Financially viable. You know, reducing your stocking density, so you've got less horses per acre. Trying to rest the pasture. As Claire mentioned, cross grazing with other species. So if other species pick up those eggs from the pasture. Because most of our parasites are host specific, they won't be able to complete their life cycle if they end up in a sheep or something like that. And the other big one actually is avoiding spreading manure. So I think, you know, there's lots of benefits to spreading manure. Unfortunately, it also spreads parasites around. So we really want to try and avoid doing that, and avoiding harrowing paddocks as well, because what we're actually doing is just spreading parasites around. And I do realise, you know, it's all very well for me to sort of sit here and say, you know, go and poo pick twice weekly. The horse trust, large parts of it are on very steep hills in very large fields. So, you know, we've got mechanical poo pickers, which are, they're not as good as going around with a wheelbarrow and shovel, but at least everyone still speaks to me if we have mechanical ones. So, there's an element of sometimes you have to kind of take the option you can. We know that in the winter, getting those poo pickers up and down some of the hills and across the muddy fields, it's completely impossible. So, you know, we have to have a combination of hand poo picking our smaller paddocks, mechanically picking the larger fields, and then knowing that, in fact, our winter paddocks, we're going to have to rest for a really good period over the summer, because actually it's the best thing that we can do. So, you know, I don't think anyone can do this. Well, no, there'll be people out there who are doing this perfectly, but there is a bit of a reality to it. So I think what you have to do is look at the look at those reduction options, see which ones you can achieve, do the best you can with them. And you will find it's one of those things that all those little things will make a difference. So I think trying to do it all perfectly sometimes can make it seem like an impossible task, but I think don't, it's probably my biggest thing is don't beat yourself up if you're not perfect, just kind of do the best you can do.
That's brilliant advice, Nicola, like absolutely spot on.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that gives us all something to work for, with, as you say, without beating ourselves up, because you know, it's hard, particularly this time of year. It's January. It's currently freezing cold outside, so the ground actually is frozen solid. But a week ago it was muddy, and I think next week it's also going to be muddy. There's no winning at this time of year, really, is there?
No, there's no way I'm going out with a wheelbarrow and a shovel at this time of year across those fields, you know. So
we're on clay, so yeah, you'd kill yourself. We're in a bog.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, I mean, obviously, we're talking about the weather. What maybe are some of the weather conditions then that might be able to help or hinder this parasite control that we've got going?
Yeah, parasites like it warm and wet, basically. So spring and autumn are really key times where we see peak in parasite infection risk. But also with our autumns getting warmer and our climate change, that's also going to impact. You know, the more temperate we become, the higher the parasite infection risk to our horses. We tend to, all of the textbooks say that we should see less worm infection during the summer and when it's really hot and arid, because that the UV light can then break the eggs down and impact that in a positive way. However, we saw statistically during the summer where it was really, really hot, you know, and all our paddocks were burnt off. I think because the horses were really cropping closer to the soil and having to work really hard, actually the parasite infection didn't dip in the way that we thought it might. It actually rose slightly. So, but it does have a really big impact. You know, farmers will tell you about a particular year in the 1960s where liver fluke went haywire and just ripped through flocks of sheep and caused a lot of death and disease, and that's because it was warm and wet. So we know that when the eggs are on the pasture, the larvae can travel a lot further in the wet, supposedly, than they can in the dry. So we're looking at a pile of dung, and from what I've read, the larvae can travel like 3 meters away in the wet, where it's only a meter when it's very dry. So it helps the motility of them, and then that makes our life much more difficult.
The basic what I'm hearing is there's no real way of winning this.
It's just a continual thing.
This frozen weather, I think we're down at -7 this morning. I think that's the big problem we have in the UK. It doesn't quite get cold enough to kill them off, and it never quite gets hot enough. But I don't know whether -7 might have just about done it. That's what I'm living in hope, that this week, the one thing it's done is hopefully break up some of our winter parasites.
Because that is definitely usually the advice. That is usually the advice, isn't it? Is that if you are going to have to worm, to do it when it's frosty, so that what comes out the other end gets, you know, chilled a bit. Like, is that true?
I think it's also to do with from our perspective, we would say that the parasites on the pasture, like below 6 degrees, they really slow down. So then if we are hopefully getting a more sustained winter period where you're getting a lower activity, that would then be the time to do your encysted redworm treatment if you were going to do that, because it would mean then that there was less chance of reinfection and of more encysted redworm occurring, so that you'd got them in that before. Mostly we see the mass emergence in springtime. It's either triggered by daylight length or temperature rise. So hopefully you'll have got most of your encysted redworm burden then. The activity is then kind of at least lowered on the pasture before you get into the spring and that max potential. It can happen any time, but if you've got a good strategy in place in your year plan, then if you've not got high worm egg counts, there's very much lower chance of having those redworm there to insist. So it's all a balance, really, though.
And then what about the environment then? I mean, again, we've sort of touched on it, but if you are worming, you are putting chemicals into your horse, which are, as we've said, coming out the other end. Is there an environmental impact then of using these chemicals?
Oh my God, massive. Yeah, I mean, it's a real passion project of mine. You just have to watch any nature program and see the massive decline in population that we've had of all of our key species. And that really starts at the micro. And so when I went on a deep dive in this, I was really shocked to discover that actually, if you put an ivermectin wormer in a horse, up to 95% of that can pass right through the horse unmetabolized, and it lands out in the dung on our pasture. So, and it's there then doing the exact same that it's designed to do to the worms, which is to paralyze them, but it's doing it in the environment. So the dung beetles that are like first line of defense in terms of breaking down the muck, it goes into our other like species, worms and other invertebrates. It can leach into watercourses where it's really poisonous to aquatic life. And then also it gets taken up by plants. So like it can even reduce germination and root growth by 30% in our grasses, you know, and if we're trying to get a good sward there that's going to minimize our mud, then this is all like big impacts that it's having. And then it goes right up through the food chain into our flagship species, you know, our barn owls, our foxes, right the way through. So it's a really massive issue. And I think we need to be much more aware of the impact that these chemicals have on them. You know, if there's any motivation for doing your poo picking and reducing the use of them, then this really should be it. But it doesn't mean not giving a wormer. Like if you need to treat, you need to treat, and you need to pick the right chemical. And even though of all of the wormers that we've got licensed in this country, ivermectin is the most toxic to our dung beetles and other populations in the environment, it actually is a really useful drug. So when you need to use it, like you need to use it, and so not hold off. But we need to be managing that so that we prevent that in getting into the environment like it does. So for most chemicals, they reach their highest concentration 24 to 48 hours after being administered. So we're looking at like, what's the peak excretion time? Can we take our horses like off the pasture for that time, stable them even just for that bit, or put them in a smaller paddock where it's really easy then to poo pick diligently, like twice a day to take it off? We also know that particularly ivermectin is really resilient in the environment. So they've sampled dung piles contaminated with ivermectin like 45 days later and still found high levels of it. So it's still acting on the pasture after that time. So if we can take them off that, put it in a compost heap, and they call it thermophilic composting, so it's like above 60 degrees, that then breaks those compounds down and it makes them safe. So then they can be in the muck heap, they can break down, makes them safe. And then if we are going to spread that dung on the pasture at any point, because I know people do that to put back fertilizer, waiting, well, it's a few weeks for our wormers, but we've also got to think about the worm eggs that could be in there, and waiting at least 6 months for those to break down and to minimize spreading infection again on the pasture would be a really good thing. So yeah, lots to consider on that score as well. But yeah, that's my plea. And I'm a little dung beetle fan, but I won't go into that. We haven't got time for that.
Well, I think, yeah, your passion for that was definitely coming through. But it's, as you say, it's a very important issue. And it's why it's so important that, you know, you're getting all the prevention stuff right, you're getting all the testing stuff right, so that you're drugging as little as you have to, so as you say, it's not going into the environment. I think we've had a really interesting conversation here. We talked about a lot of very interesting things, and hopefully there's been a lot that people listening can learn from. If you had to pick one sort of take home message for people listening, what would it be? Who wants to go first?
Can I have two?
I'll be generous. You can have two.
Poo picking as much as you possibly can and as well as you possibly can. And the other one is just thinking about that risk profile and getting some advice on how you can best use a targeted worming program.
Perfect. Claire, what about you?
Oh, that's brilliant. So you've had one, or at least two of mine, that I was thinking of, so I can have something else. That's great. I think really mine would be, like, off the back of that, getting your strategy right would be to get your reduction testing in, because until we start looking for this trouble, we're just not going to know the extent of it. And it just means that putting chemicals in is ineffective. So it really helps us to choose right chemical for the right situation, right time of year. And I think I'd follow up that by just saying that blanket worming programs are just so irresponsible now. You know, they're so old hat. Definitely, as Nicola was saying, get your strategy right.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, everyone. If you've listened to this and you want to, you know, you want to look into this, want to find out more, speak to your vets, speak to your SQPs. There's loads of information out there, and it is, as you've discovered from listening to this, really, really important that you get it right. So thank you to Claire, thank you to Nicola for joining me this evening, and yeah, thanks everyone for listening.